So, as I was saying, welcome to the Library of the Jewish Theological Seminary for the special program for Yom HaShoah, or more formally, Yom HaShoah V'Hagvura, the day for the recollection of the Holocaust and for heroism during the Holocaust. This program, as you will hear more details about in a moment, originates with our focus on the very rich and often quite amazing archives of Johanna Spector and material in that collection which reflects her life, and her life in connection to events of the Holocaust is something that we will address here this afternoon. But in addition, as you just saw, we have in our collection some really remarkable rare materials. As I'm sure you know, the library collects rare materials and has one of the most outstanding collections of rare Judaic materials in the world. For us, rare Jewish books are not just old ones, meaning not just, you know, from the 14th, 15th, 16th century, earlier and later. They're also recent materials, the historical importance of which we recognize, and what you've seen here are quite rare. And we're very grateful that they've survived, because it gives us some insight into aspects of the experience of Jews during and immediately following the Holocaust, which otherwise would be unavailable. We have a very special program. You will hear readings from Johanna Spector's own writing. You will hear songs that she composed. You'll have a chance to see some of the images here. Included, the reason we're holding this commemoration in this space is because we at the library also have a Holocaust memorial, which is probably the most neglected and least known spaces in the entirety of the Jewish Theological Seminary, but we wanted to revive it. And so we thought it would be an appropriate place to hold this event. We'll hear more about that in a little while as well. Permit me to introduce Naomi Steinberger, who is director of library services here at the JTS Library, and she'll say more about the Johanna Spector collection and more, therefore, about this program.
We are grateful to you coming, and we're grateful to the Chair of the Council of Library Information Resources, who funded the processing of the Johanna Spector archives. And part of the grant to process these collections is to have public programs related to the collections of Johanna Spector, and to let people know what we're finding. Tonight is a series of part of our series. It is in commemoration of Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, and tells a different side of the Johanna Spector story than we anticipated. Johanna Spector, who Cal Leon is going to tell us a bit more, was an ethnomusicologist and worked in non-Western Jewish music. This, it tells her personal story of her personal life in Europe. I just want to introduce Michaela Biondi, who is the project archivist on the project, and she's going to
Good evening. I'm Michaela Biondi, as was mentioned, and I'll just read. Johanna Lichtenberg Spector was born in 1950 in Latvia. The oral history done in the 70s with Janet Bookspan, she stated that she had a happy childhood in an upper-middle-class neighborhood of Upper Lubao. Her father was a successful businessman, and her mother was a pianist who taught her children to love music and art and all the performing arts. And her older brother, Naum, became a professional violinist in his teens. Johanna herself was an outstanding student with the intentions of becoming a physician, but through a turn of events, she was led to the conservatory in Vienna and earned a piano and teaching degree from the State Academy there as well. Through connections with musicians in Lubao, she met and later married Viennese concert pianist Robert Spector, who's got a picture up here through the running of the images. In 1941, the couple had a very bright future before them. They had just published two books and had accepted teaching posts at the conservatory in Riga and were invited to perform and lead master classes at the conservatory in Moscow. Most of the information we have about Johanna's war experiences in Lubao and in the camps comes from a journal that she wrote during her recuperation and from the oral history mentioned earlier, and as well from letters that were written for to the United Restitution Organization in support of Spector's claims to recover family property in Latvia, being the last survivor of her family on both sides, husband's and hers. Spector rarely spoke about her war experiences with people who hadn't been through them. So that's why this is a bit of a surprise. We weren't expecting all of this. News reports on the invasion of Latvia at the time were very confusing, and it seemed to Spector that the Latvians were happy to do Hitler's bidding before the Germans even arrived, implementing the restrictions, claiming property, curbing their movements, and forcing them to wear the yellow star. In mid-July, the elimination campaigns began. For over 4 days, 3,000 Jews disappeared, including Robert Spector, who never returned home from work on July 22nd. In the last major campaign against Lubao's Jews in 1941, over 2,000 people were rounded up and executed en masse in a town called Skida, just slightly north of Lubao, between December 15th and 17th. This campaign claimed her father, mother, brother, and both in-laws. She never knew exactly why she had been given a special ID exempting her from arrest during those days, but she speculated that her Russian language skills made her invaluable in managing the supplies left behind by the Russians in the naval port where she worked. Or was it that she was a pianist and one of the officers wanted piano lessons? She speculated on this, but she never really knew. By the beginning of 1942, the 815 Jews left of the original 10,000 in Lubao were relocated to a constructed ghetto there. Here, Spector shared living space with a school friend, Sigrid Zamir, and worked at the naval port until October 1943, when the remaining 300 prisoners of the 10,000 in Lubao were sent to Kaiserwald concentration camp near the capital city in Riga. From Kaiserwald, she went through a series of forced labor camps near the northern coast of Poland, Kresów, Stutthof, Stolp, Burgraben, and then returning to Stolp before her liberation. What work did she do? A 1954 article about her in the National Jewish Post reported that she was put to work repairing the railroads. In the oral history, she would only say that she did carrying and digging during the war. A song included in the KZ Lieder describes using people to dig through a mountain of mud and rock to carve out a tunnel for the railroad, and it supports this report. And there's a song about it actually as well as an illustration you'll see, the color one, for the cover of the KZ Lieder. A question from the oral history asked, where were you when liberation occurred? And Spector replies, we were shipwrecked. We were put out to sea before the war ended on a ship with a yellow flag because the camp, Stutthof, had been infected with typhus and typhoid, and most of the people who were put on the ship were ill. Also, there were criminals, Polish criminals, murderers and such, and it was a very rough ride. We were about 65 on this ship. They threw people alive overboard. They wanted the little bread or water that they had. We could not land anywhere. Nobody would let a ship like that land. We were just put out to sea. In the beginning, there was a crew, but after a while, the crew abandoned the ship. The British didn't know what kind of ship it was, and so they bombed the ship, and it ran, most fortunately, onto a sandbank. Some of the prisoners were taken off by a fire ship, which happens to be in the vicinity. The owner of an estate nearby saw the ship, and he sent a boat to investigate what it was, and he was told that these were people from the concentration camps because, you know, we were wearing the suits, the striped suits. And he sent people to the ship asking whether we would like to be taken ashore, and then he himself came. His name was Graf von Moltke, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. That was in northern Germany near Flensburg, and the date of her rescue was May 3rd, 1945. We were brought to a hospital. First, we were in the basement, not the hospital at all, because it was full. But I couldn't walk. It took me 3 months to walk, to learn how to walk again, because I was very, very ill. It was mostly starvation, but it was also typhoid, typhus, and dysentery. And as soon as I could walk, I wanted to study. When asked why she felt she was allowed to live, Spector replied, "I have a feeling that since I survived of these millions of Jews who were killed, I must have a task to perform, and that's why I went into Jewish studies. I knew music best, and I was Jewish, and I felt very Jewish, and I suffered for it, and my people have been killed for it, so I'd like to do something for the Jews, and I did. And the collection that we're working on is the legacy of that determination to live." Thank you.
And now I want to call on Etta Abramson, who is a graduate student in the Davidson School and a professional singer and dramatic reader. And she is going to be reading some excerpts from Johanna Spector's diaries. They were written in German and translated by one of our archivists on the project, Nicole Greenhouse, who was on jury duty. So she is not here, but Etta, I'm sure, will do a wonderful reading. And
thank you. Just a note of introduction that this is a diary entry. It was a letter that was never sent to somebody named Vonya, who was Johanna Spector's cousin, Solomon, who was living in the United States at the time. Vonya, do you remember how we sat in the kitchen in the summer and Mama placed in front of us smoked herring and salad? Everything was so colorful, whetting my appetite. The radishes, cucumbers, tomatoes, and sour cream. But that was a long time ago. I'm not a 17-year-old anymore, and a lot has happened since then. Vienna, the Academy, classes in Lübeck with Walter Hahn, the famous conductor, then back to Vienna, then the move to Riga and building of a new life, marriage and the shared advancement with my husband. How wonderful were those years of tireless work, of successes. There was no looking left or right, only forwards. We wrote two books. I gave lectures. Robert played. And shortly before disaster befell us, we were supposed to travel to Moscow. We were hired to be teachers at the conservatory in Riga for the fall. Today, we would have both been professors. Robert played increasingly more beautiful, even, and mature. He was becoming a major artist. And then the 22nd of July came. War. Wieden Street, Court Street, Helene Street, Grove Street were all covered in soot and ash. On the very first day, no stone was left unturned. The majority of Jews lived or had no shops in that area. We took refuge for a week in a basement with some others. We changed shelters four times, from one end of town to the other. Everywhere burned. The whole city burned that last night we moved back to the beach. It was a horrible sight, the view of the sea of flames. I had an impression that it was only sets that were ablaze, and that walls fell together as if they were made of cardboard. Monia, Monia, how horrible, almost unbearable that 1 week appeared to me. Robert could not tolerate the bombs. He had to spend the time lying down, his ears were oversensitive, and he could not bear horrible noise. When the fighter planes approached, he had to place a pillow over his head to protect his eardrums. He felt very bad the entire time, and his heart was not right. We were told conflicting news, but not a piece of news was reliable. Robert did not want to work. He always had better instincts than me for everything. As soon as the war broke out, he wanted to go immediately east. He urged and pleaded with me, "We have to go immediately away." But I stopped at my parents and his parents. I wanted to visit them. I thought that it would be better to be in danger if we all stayed together. And so our family held together. No one was thinking about things, property, apartments any longer. Many were made homeless during the bomb raid and moved in with acquaintances and relatives. We also thought that our house did not stand anymore because the entire local street was swept down. But our house stood And our apartment was undisturbed just as we had left it. It was a shock because everything around us was burned down. Then, the subjugation of Jews began systematically. All Jews waited hours to receive the J and a number in their passport. It then briefly crossed my mind not to register and to flee. Like lambs, we went unknowingly to the slaughterhouse. The naivete of the Jews was borderless, especially for the intelligent. We will go work. We will go along with it for a time. How long could this last? The war is over. We are once again people with our human rights. People thought about murder only in passing. And mass murder was the last thing on their minds. There were only 4 stores that the 8,000 Jews were allowed to buy groceries at. And I will never forget how long my brother Uma stood in the road, often patiently waiting hours to buy groceries. The rest of us were too nervous and agitated to stand there, but Uma chatted with friends to pass the time. Always Uma. I can't think about him without crying. Now I know how much I loved him. He was so helpless and thereby good-hearted. What took him from his life? Just as he began to enjoy his life as a violin teacher and violinist in the National Theater, he had to leave that life. I had it so well. A childhood full of sunlight. Adolescence full of work and aspirations. Studies in magnificent Vienna under artists and famous musicians, setting up our business. I could have gone. I sampled everything and knew the beautiful and the noble. But Uma deserved to experience a better future. I often ask myself, why must the good, the noble, the educated, the most intelligent, the blameless children, and the truly godly people lose their lives? Robert didn't want to work. He lay in bed and was heartsick. After 2 weeks, I convinced him to go back to work. He would feel quite differently and see that it was not so bad. We went every day to work together. Robert and I had the same service agency in the naval port next to the airport. Robert worked as a carpenter and he was very skilled. I washed soldier uniforms for 10 hours straight in the blazing sun. We saw each other only during the breakfast and lunch breaks when we were allowed to sit in the field. On the second day it rained, I didn't see Robert's face the entire day at work because there was not enough room, so the men were isolated from the women. In the evening, right before it was time to go home, I saw him briefly. He stood leaning with the others by the wall in front of the barracks to protect himself from the rain. I thought we were all going home. I said goodbye to him without a word. I didn't know that it was the last time I would see him. Robert did not come home. It was evening and soon to be night. And I couldn't stay in the house with the feeling of death. I heard shots at random from the beach. What they meant, I would later experience. Until morning, I slept erratically. As I expected, I was still alone. The bed next to me, empty. And it would stay that way. Robert was proven right. He had said to me one day, daily they take people, no one knows how or where. Should I not come home one night, go as quickly as possible to the city commander. Later it's too late. I laughed then and said, he saw ghosts. Unfortunately, there were no ghosts. It was July 22, 1941, the beginning of the largest campaigns against the young, strong, and able men. Over 4 days, 3,000 Jews were murdered. Unfortunately, there were no ghosts. I'm going to sing a song now. It's called Stiller, Stiller. means quiet to quiet. I believe that there's English displayed every once in a while on the slideshow. This song was written in the Vilna Ghetto, not by Joanna Spector, but by Shmurka Kazerginsky. The song is a lullaby, quieting a child after a massacre of Ponarvik, where 70 to 100,000 Jews were killed from, they were taken there from Vilna and shot. The song is therefore a lullaby in many ways degrades to the kiborim of Ponarvik. In the verse that I'll sing, the mother tells her child not to cry over the disappearance of his father, because enemies do not understand the tears. But by the end, the mother promises the child that soon, one day, the sun will shine again and freedom will come.
Individuals involved in organization to try to memorialize what had been in Warsaw, you may recall, this is now in front of the new Museum of Polish Jewish History, is the massive Nathan Rappaport Warsaw Ghetto Memorial. It has two sides. And those two sides were recreated in the 1960s at Yad Vashem. This was recreated here, this is only one of those sides, in miniature, though apparently with the artist's approval, since he lived in New York at the time. Only one side of the memorial. There's two sides. On one side, you've got the warriors who fought during the uprising, the leaders of that uprising. And on the other side, you've got Jews who are part of the march who would be taken away to Treblinka from the Utah Platz. If you look carefully, you can see the German soldiers and their helmets behind with the bayonets at the end of the rifle. You see that? You can see over here one of the figures looking back, right, to the home which is being left forever. Very prominently, obviously, the rabbi holding the Torah scroll with his eyes lifted up to heaven. Children are very prominent here. Of course, most hauntingly, this child with the empty eyes who looks off, and the question is that lost? Is it with accusation? There are a variety of interpretations. I do have to share that as I was researching this piece, I found an interpretation which was really quite striking and telling, and that relates to the two sides of the memorial, only one of which is here. The heroic side of the memorial is dominated by men, despite the fact that women fought side by side with the those who led the uprising, and women fought together. But in the artist's imagination, it was the men who are represented as powerful heroes, and the one woman on the other side of the memorial is a passive figure in the background. But here you can see that women are prominently represented off to their deaths, leaving this life behind. I share that only because the artist created a memory after his own image, which was a very incomplete memory as well. The memorial, as you can see, was donated by a supporter of the seminary who lived in Dallas at the time, and without reading the whole thing, the part of what you can see here is very evident and obvious, but we are grateful to all the allied nations who liberated our people and other peoples from the Nazi torture and the threat of death, the humanitarian and heroic. What's that say? Acts of the people of Denmark and Sweden shall never be forgotten for us. As the story is told and recalled, needless to say, this is a very different story than was told in 1948. I do have to add that when this memorial was dedicated in 1948 in Warsaw, the city remained destroyed for hours. The streets barely existed. It was one of the first constructions in the reconstruction of Warsaw immediately after the war, and is evidence of the commitment not only of the surviving Jews, but of the support that was provided at the time by the Soviets, whose history and relationship to Jews went through very complicated chapters, different chapters one after the other. But this is one of the first standing elements in the reconstructed Warsaw.
I know you are. Thank you. Are you a cantorial student here?
No, I just, my background's in voice. I'm a vocalist. I'm a student here. I just completed a degree in Midrash. I'm almost completing a degree in Midrash in education, but I still sing when I can.
Are you going to teach in a Midrash school?
Probably, and also maybe as a chaplain, actually, like patients.
Yeah.
Oh, hi, Matlos. This is the picture that refers to the I have no homeland, I guess. Oh, here we go. I have no homeland. I have nothing in this world. I wander from land to land. The blue sky is my tent. I cannot be happy. I know no sunshine. I have no homeland. I have nothing in this world. I wander from land to land and remain there, where people can find me. And when I finally thought, oh, can we hold it?
That's what I'm going to try to do for you.
So now there's an Israel.
Pardon?
So now there's an Israel.
This is like heavy stuff. I'm so sorry. Thank you so much for singing. I missed everything.
Yes,
what? Really?
And why? Because you just, you're
excuse me.
Yes.
Phrases to sustain without any record, just to close out.
Thank you so much.
You know, your thing is still running.
Okay, let's turn it off. I hope somebody didn't say anything that they shouldn't have been saying.